This is Danny Cox playing Hot Down in Chile on his 1974 album Feel So Good. Is a legendary Kansas City musician. For today's portrait session, we're going to talk with him about his storied past. Danny has toured nationally, performing with the likes of Ray Charles and Steve Martin. Here in Kansas City, he's been instrumental in creating some of the city's most important bohemian music venues. Places like the Vanguard Coffee House on 43rd and Main in the 1960s, and the Cowtown Ballroom over on Gillam in the 1970s. He got active in the civil rights movement when he was just in high school, missing classes to do jail time. And if you've ever heard the grass pad jingle, you know the one, the grass pad's high on grass. That's Danny Cox, too. Hi, Danny. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome to Central Standard.
Gina, thank you very much. I've listened to your program and enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Well, we just heard a little bit of a song called Hot Down in Chile from the album Feel So Good. You're known as a folk musician, but That's a pretty funky tune.
Yeah, well, you know, actually, my basic music history is actually jazz. When I was a kid, I would sit on the floor and had these old records from the old Bethlehem label, and that's what I listened to and grew up on. And my brother had a horn band. They would sit in the living room with their little sheets and play. And I was fortunate to not have any prejudices in music. All music was open to us.
Do you still feel that way today?
Oh, my God. It's only 12 notes in passion. it's like dancing, you know. You got 2 feet in gravity. How different can your steps be? We have to look hard to see the difference.
Well, that album, Feels So Good, really took off pretty big time.
It was pretty amazing because here I am, basically known as a folk singer, right? You know, my guitar. And I'm playing Soul Train. That was pretty bizarre. But that song is important in my life. I went down to Mexico for a 2 weeks vacation, stayed 7.5 years. And I had a horse ranch down there. I trained horses for years.
That's a long vacation.
Yes, my watch broke. I lost track of time. You know how it is. It happens to you. And the news that you get out of this country is quite different than what you get here.
What years are we talking
about?
We're
talking about early 1970s, way back in the back, way back machine. In late 60s when it was so volatile in South and Central America. And Allende had been elected president in a Democratic election. But, of course, being a Marxist, we didn't like that. And so we sent our CIA boys down, and he was killed. It was just simple as that. Now, in America, the news, because we hear the Army broadcast, because they played a lot of wonderful music. And their news story was simply that some radicals had killed Allende. You listen to the Mexican radio and they say, yeah, the CIA went down and blew the dude away. And that's what this song is about, Hot Down in Chile. Sauce is pouring fast, you know. And we have to watch out because not only will it happen here, it has happened here.
When you were in Mexico, I mean, is that when you wrote the song, or
yes,
did you write it when you came back?
I wrote it when I was in Mexico.
Why? It's so interesting that you chose that really funky backdrop for this ominous, disturbing political expose.
Well, because I wanted it to move you. I wanted to, you know, the music of South America, you know, you see, the Mardi Gras, the music, no matter what they're saying, the music moves you, and I wanted the music to do that. I wanted it to be funky. I wanted you to hit your spirit and your soul so that the words would hit you the same. Because they're repetitive. It's not one of my songs where I have I'm very wordy in a lot of my songs, but this is one that just was just so simple, you know, and you had a repeating the chorus, you know, and so it just went along with that chant that the music was like.
A lot of your songs are about love and that kind of thing, but a lot of your songs are also about freedom and they're political. Is musical totally connected to politics and social justice for you, or do these things just happen to cross over sometimes?
When I was in kindergarten, I saw something that was so important. It kept with me for the rest of my life. There was a bin of beans, and it would open. The telephone company had this exhibit going around. And it would open, and the beans would fall. Bing! And always there would be some to the left, some to the right, but most of them just fell right down in the middle. And we'd pick them up, and it would fall again. And every once in a while, some change, if you tilted it a little bit, you'd have more going to the left one time, more the other way. But generally, they fell in the middle. And you had these radicals on both sides, and you just hoped that you never ran into either one of them.
I want to listen to a song called Redneck from one of your early albums. Yeah.
How can you ask the boys in Vietnam to put down the guns as you polish up your rifle in the night and cap your stolen sticks of dynamite? How can you ask the greed heads of the north and of the south to do the turnabout as you polish up your rifle in the night and cap your stolen sticks of dynamite? It's crazy. It's written in the sky. Painted on every face. You know you got to reap a dish of what you sow, and your neck don't have to be red.
The song starts with the line, "How can you ask the boys in Vietnam to put down the guns as you polish rifles in the night?" What inspired that song?
Every major city was on fire. They don't teach you that in high school. Every major city was on fire. We had radical groups that were not the Black Panthers. They were white. They captured Patty Hearst.
So is this song against radicalization?
It's about, you know, if you're going to just be a person who goes and takes, how can you talk about somebody else who just goes and takes? And that says, you know, how can you ask these boys in Vietnam to put down their guns while you're picking yours up and polishing your rifle?
One of the lines in there, forgive me if I'm getting this not quite right, is that your neck doesn't have to be red for you to be a redneck.
That's right. Yes, your neck don't have to be red. Because we always thought of redneck people as just being white. But the concept of what we think being a redneck is, you know, that concept of not caring, of trying to hold somebody else back, can be held by anybody. A good example is I used the man who came around my neighborhood and sold insurance to people.
You tell that story in the song too. Tell it to us now.
It says, when I was young, there was a man, his face was black, insurance was his game. He sold you futures for a dime if you'd only sign your name on the dotted line and page week on time. It's crazy. You paid, the years rolled past your door, and there's nothing there to show, though you still see him in your town still selling futures to the poor. It's crazy. Your neck don't have to be red to be.
You were born in 1942 in Ohio, so you were a teenager as the Civil Rights Movement was gearing up. What do you remember about race from your childhood?
Well, I remember that, when I was a kid, first of all, your life was a block. Even in your ghetto, if you went over to the other side of the block, They were all black people, but you were in another neighborhood. You know, it was very small. But racism was rampant. I mean, I just can't tell you. People were being hung. There were hundreds of people every year being lynched.
How close to home did that get for you?
Well, it got pretty close to home because we had a wonderful magazine called Jet Magazine and a magazine called Ebony who told the truth. And you wouldn't see it anywhere else in any other publication, but these magazines showed pictures of the lynchings, and you could see them. When Emmett Till was killed in the South, this young boy from Chicago, and he was brutally hung and castrated, and, I mean, it was terrible. His mother boldly refused to have anything done to him. She put him in the coffin the way he was so that we could see what this was about. Only Jet and Ebony showed the pictures.
When you saw those images, what went through your mind?
Oh, anger, total anger. I mean, anger. You just wanted to go out and strangle somebody. That's what you wanted to do.
What did you do? Because obviously not that.
No, I didn't. You know, I was blessed with wonderful parents and siblings who taught us about brothers and sisters of the hearts, not of the blood, not of the family. You find your brothers and sisters of the heart, and that's what you do. You don't know what color they're going to be. You don't know where they're going to be. That's what you find.
I've heard that you have an older sister who had a rebellious spirit that kind of inspired you.
Margaret is something else, man. Margaret's 9 years older than me, and she was bad. She said, protect us all. Well, one day, Margaret went to a Catholic school because of the advantages of the Catholic education. And, what happens is that Mother Superior comes home with my sister and tells my mother my sister will not say the Pledge of Allegiance, expecting my mother to be a typical mother. And, you, Margaret, you better do what you're told in school. You little black girl, you ought to be grateful that this is happening for you, you know, that kind of stuff. And my mother says, well, Margaret, why won't you say it? And she said, well, Mother Superior told me not to lie and that there is no justice and freedom for all in this country, and I won't say it. My mother just said, there you are.
How old were you when this took place?
7 years old.
And it sounds like a really big impression on you. What did that teach you?
Well, it just told me that I had a strong mother that I could rely on. It told me that I should watch what my sister's doing. She seems to be walking the right road.
Was Ohio a hotbed of civil rights activity?
Oh, it was the hotbed for going down to the South on the Freedom Rides. You know, you had all these radical colleges in Yellow Springs, Ohio, Oberlin, you know, familiar with them.
Yeah, I've heard of that one.
And so that's where you went to train. And it was tough, man. You stood there, and people would come up to you and call your names. You see, I got to say the word. You may bleep it out. They say nigger, you know, call you that, and spit in your face and everything.
You had to get you ready.
Get you ready, because you didn't expect to come back alive. You didn't. You had to, matter of fact, you had to sign your will. You did not expect to come back alive.
So how did you go down to the South?
I was too young, because I couldn't sign a will. But I remember the night our group went down, and to this moment, we stayed up all night, waiting to hear from them that they would be safe. I'm sorry, I'm getting...
No, it's okay.
Very emotional about it. But hoping that they would... Because they were killing people, you understand? They were setting the buses on fire. They were blowing people away. It wasn't play.
Yeah, and so you were just waiting to hear that your friends made it okay and...
Made it, were safe, yes.
How did you experience all of this at the age you were just entering your teenage years? What did it look like from that vantage point as a young black man coming of age?
Well, for me, I knew that I had two experiences that really affected me. One of which was we were picketing a building, and this man came up to me and he started calling the name. What you doing here? What do you think is happening? And we have been told to just say, you know, sir, please come back, something nice to him. And boy, he got mad. He came back again. Next day, did the same thing. The third day, he was standing on the line with us.
Wow. So what were you doing exactly?
I was being kind to this man in spite of what he was saying to me. I was being kind to him, and it prevailed.
And just changed his mind?
Changed his mind. And it happened again when we were picketing a swimming pool, and it was sitting down, and they told us, you know, as long as we sat there, nobody else could get in, see. So this policeman comes up, and he grabs me by the collar, and I'm sitting down. I'm just about the level where his gun is. You can smell it, you know, the oil and the leather, you know, and the coldness from it. And he picked up, he had a nightstick, and he says, "You don't get up, I'm going to hit you in your blung, blung, blung head." And, you know, he meant it, because they were doing that. And we had had a meeting maybe a week before, and we had a woman who was traveling around the country telling us her story. And she had said what she had done in a similar situation. And I didn't know that what she had said had really become a part of me. So it started coming out of my mouth. And I didn't want it to come out of my mouth, but it did. I just looked up at this man and said, "I'm going to beat you with love." You got a gun and a stick, right? I'm going to beat him with love. We were both so shocked. He was so shocked he had heard it. I was so shocked that I had said it, that we both went to, I call it the land of, huh? And when you're in that land, there's nothing you can do to anybody.
Everybody loses their script a little bit.
Yes. And he just pushed me and walked away.
But so you did. You beat him with love.
Yeah, I guess I did. I guess I did. But you don't always win. I mean, you don't always win against bullets, man. I'm a realist. You know, I mean, those poor people in Kenya, you know, they could have sat there. When you're up, it's not always in balance. Like I said, every once in a while, the whole thing moves and you have more beans go this way for a while.
Yeah. Well, you were saying that you were in a meeting and this woman had made this comment that got stored up in your brain. Yeah. What kinds of meetings? Were you a part of a group?
Oh, yeah. I was part of something called the Fellowship House, which was a pretty left-wing group of young people, you know. And we did community work, and it was totally integrated. And that's what we did. We did community work. We'd go out in communities. We'd help older people who couldn't paint their homes. We'd do all kinds of wonderful things.
And you missed school sometimes to go to jail?
Oh, yeah. I'd tell them, you know, excuse me from school today. I'm going to protest, and you know I'm going to be arrested.
How many times have you been to jail?
About four times, you know. And it was so funny. They didn't know what to do with me because, you know, they knew they had the language for adults, you know, call them the names and everything. But they didn't know what to say to me, you know.
Just a little kid.
Yeah. You know, didn't have the language for it.
The teen years, I'm guessing, are also when you got involved more seriously anyway in music. How did that happen?
Well, music was never anything beyond just fun. I had never, not even the slightest consideration of going into music. None whatsoever. My sister sang, as I said, she was on this tour that was on. My brother, still to this day, he's 82 years old, and he has a voice that's a tenor, operatic tenor voice that's so beautiful.
I want to hear it.
Oh, it's absolutely beautiful, man. My uncle had a famous gospel quartet. We sang around the house all the time. And so, but my real big thing was art. I was going to be a high school art teacher. I had a scholarship to study art.
So what changed your path?
The summer between high school and art, well, not quite the summer, maybe the last 2 weeks before graduation from school, John Sweet and I, my good friend, we went to a coffee house to see what a beatnik looked like.
Your mission?
Yes. We heard about beatniks, you know? They were long before hippies, you know?
And you knew they were in coffee shops?
Yeah, that's how they were. They hung out in coffee shops and did poetry and wore berets and stuff, you know? So we went to see what a beatnik looked like. And they had an open mic, and the guy said, you know, anybody can get up and sing. And John said, let's get up and sing a couple of things. And we said, well, no, let's sing some of the things. We sing the protest songs. We got up and we sang a few songs. John played guitar. I didn't play guitar at the time. John played guitar and we sang a couple of songs. And, excuse me, the management said, wow, you guys want to come back here and work?
So that was your first gig?
That was it. And we said, okay. And he gave us money beyond what we could believe, you know, in the early 60s. And and the summer was just crazy. I was just, man, I was total inertia. There was nothing of me had anything to do with it. It was total inertia, just moving down the line. And time came to go to school. John went to school. John went to Cornell and got his law degree and came back to and start working. I continued doing this thing, and it's almost a laugh and say it now, but it was like almost like this. 30 years later, I kind of woke up and went, oh, what happened?
You know? Tell me about the Hootenanny folk tour.
Ah, that was fabulous. You know, Hootenanny was a word back then. With my old manager, we put on a local Hootenanny, and that was the word, Hootenanny. Man, it was just like, it was magic. And so we had so many people, we had to turn them away. So we put on another one, same thing. So Irv, I remember, said, hey, man, why don't we take this up to Dayton, Ohio, 50 miles away. We took it up to Dayton. It just took off. All of a sudden, we played, was it six shows at Kill Auditorium in St. Louis, one after the other, just like the old black shows, you know, where you'd have in the theater where you'd play one show, take them out and bring in another show, take them out and bring another show. We did six shows there. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
And we eventually went on to Carnegie Hall, sold out four shows at Carnegie Hall, and it was just magic.
Is this one of the highlights of your career?
It is one of the highlights of my career. I mean, I remember walking, I kind of remember because I was in a daze, walking back up to the dressing room past these pictures of all these incredible people who had been there. Just in this daze, and the guy came back and got me and says, hey, they want you for an encore. And I went, oh, okay. It was a dream. It was a real dream, man.
Danny Cox, we've got to take a short break. When Central Standard returns, we'll hear Danny Cox's earliest memories of Kansas City during the segregation era. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and my guest on today's show is Danny Cox. He's a musician here in town, and his story has landed him in the middle of some really important American moments, musical moments, as well as moments of social upheaval. More about that shortly. Danny, when did you first visit Kansas City?
Well, I came here in 1963, and it wasn't pleasant at first. We had reservations at the Muehlbach Hotel, and the guy, and it meant no words with him, I'm going to say it again because you have to say the truth. He said, told me and my sisters, ain't no niggers going to stay at the Muehlbach.
What year is this?
It's 1963.
So 1 year before the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah. They don't stay. And so naturally as a group, we said, well, they said the recipe was very supportive of us. Say, well, if they can't stay here, we're not staying here. So we all left. We came over to Kansas City, Kansas. And there used to be an old Holiday Inn right there, that big building that overlooks the Three Rivers. And they welcomed us without knowing what had happened to us. There, they welcomed us with open arms, were so kind to us, just naturally.
Was the decision to cross the state line deliberate? I mean, did you think we better get on the other side of this line, or is that just a coincidence?
There was a coincidence, but once we got there, we saw the difference between a slave state and a free state. You think about Kansas, public accommodation laws came from here. Brown versus the Board of Education came from Kansas. I mean, it's interesting. And then you got Missouri, which is the most dangerous place in the world. During the 1860s, it was the most dangerous place in the world to be.
Is it hard for you to live in a place that has that as the first memory for you? I mean,
well, you know, there's a certain level of the beans falling in the middle. And it seems to be one of the things I've learned is that there's a certain dynamic that has to exist in all relationships. It may not be as severe as the beans to the right, but it will be to the right of whatever you're in. It will be to the left of whatever you're in. So no matter what you're in, you're gonna encounter this. You're going to have to learn how to live happily within it without compromising all. Because you have to compromise something. I mean, you'd just be, unless you just want to stand there and just in the wind and blow and forget about everybody in your life.
When you went to that Holiday Inn on the Kansas side of the state line, was that the beginning of a special relationship with Kansas City, Kansas? Because do you live in Kansas City, Kansas
now? I live
in
Kansas City, Kansas now. Yes, I do. And it didn't, it's interesting. It didn't occur to me at the time when I came here because our offices at Good Karma Productions, Bruin Shipley and I came out from the West Coast to be a member of this company called Good Karma Productions. We're at 43rd Main.
What was Good Karma Productions?
It was a company that managed me, Bruin Shipley, a young man by the name of Ted Anderson, who wrote Seems Like a Long Time on Rod Stewart album, another young man, Chet Nichols. You'll see Chet, and Chet is now an actor. Chet had an unfortunate situation. We were doing a concert in Denver with the Jefferson Starship, and he was opening for them, and no one had told him not to drink the Kool-Aid.
Oh.
And Chet drank the Kool-Aid, and he went out on stage, and his guitar disappeared on him.
Wow.
Yes, wow is right. And that sort of ended his career. He was never the same after that.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yes. He went back to Chicago and became a really quite an executive. And then he got into movies. If you look at Payback, the movie, he's in that. He's in Good Burgers. He's a cop that gets kicked in, you know, ganoids.
So it sounds like Good Karma is kind of like a label, what we would today call a record label.
Well, it was a production company. We had Arrowhead Stadium for 2 years. We brought in the Rolling Stones, Chicago, people like that. We booked concerts, and we started the NEC Booking Conference Colleges. We started that, and which meant the colleges would book as groups and have to pay less for, you know, artists. And artists came out better because it cost them less to travel. But we were a production company is what we were.
So you came back to be a part of that?
Yes.
So how did the experience you had stopping here in Kansas City, that really negative experience, how did that compare with your travels to other places as a touring musician? Because it does seem just incredible that you would end up back in this place where this happened to you.
Yeah, I remember I came here from San Francisco.
So you had some time in California, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I stayed a long time there, long, long time there. But, you know, what it ends up with all the time is the people. The end result is the people, you know. There was nothing so severe in Kansas City that I wouldn't encounter anywhere else, you know.
That's such a sad statement in a way, because that story is really disturbing.
It is.
And that was just kind of normal?
Oh, it is. I mean, it was very, remember, as I said, every major city was on fire. I didn't teach you that in high school, I know. But everyone, I was traveling, I was there, everyone with tanks rolling down the streets of Detroit.
What was it like when you first moved to Kansas City? What was Kansas City like to live in? What year did you move here?
Well, I came here in the late 60s, okay? And I stayed a couple of years. And then that's when I moved to Mexico. And so it was, and I'd come up every once in a while, you know what I'm saying, to do concerts and tours and all. But Kansas City was just big old sprawling town that was divided by Troost Avenue.
Sounds familiar.
Yes, divided by, and it was a difference between, and the oasis was Westport, Westport was the oasis.
What do you mean?
Westport was where you had the head shops, the coffee houses that brought all kinds of different people together. People that normally, if they were in their own neighborhoods, would never be together.
One of the things you're known for in Kansas City is being part of the Vanguard Coffee House on 43rd and Main.
Yeah.
You were a regular performer there. Tell us about the Vanguard.
Vanguard was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. You did three shows a night, okay? They would change the audience after every show. And it was like doing a concert. Unlike, you know, playing a bar. You know, it was really like doing a concert.
Were people quiet to listen?
It was like doing a concert. These coffee houses were incredible. A good example is a coffee house in Washington called the Cellar Door. The waiters would crawl on the floor to deliver a drink, not to pass between you and the audience.
I'm sorry I missed that.
Oh, it was, and you would come see the coffee house, and you would come with your set, and you'd give it to the guy, and it was a light booth. And he would look at your set, and you'd play it for him, and he would then chart a light score for your set. And it's dramatic. It was so dramatic. It was fabulous, man. So when that happened, all of a sudden you woke up and you're playing bars. Hey, buddy, yeah, right on. You know?
That's quite a change. But the Vanguard Coffee House, I'm assuming that's named after the Village Vanguard in New York?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, I'm really not sure. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of debate about that because Stan, for a while, thought he owned that name. We had to point out to him that there was the Vanguard.
Stan, the owner.
Yeah. And the Vanguard Airlines, there were a lot of Vanguards.
That's funny.
Around. But we had, so many wonderful people. Steve Martin played there, a Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Linda Ronstadt, when she had the Stone Ponies. And I mean, it's just a wonderful, wonderful group of people.
And then you were one of the co-owners of the Cowtown Ballroom.
Cowtown Ballroom.
Yeah, that was over in the El Torreon building. Yes. Tell me that story. Tell me the story of the Cowtown Ballroom.
Well, the Cowtown Ballroom, the room was owned by a guy in Minneapolis. And we had it for $2,000 a month. That's pretty cheap. So we tried once again to live up to our name, Good Karma. We did dollar concerts, you know, you come and see. And at one point, which very few people knew about in this town, we had a program called Lee Jeans Presents, sponsored by Lee Jeans. We had the top mobile unit parked out and back, and we recorded every concert. We own to this day 16-track recordings of B.B. King, Seals and Croft, It's a Beautiful Day, Mitch Ryder, Detroit Wheels, these great icons, the Byrds last live concert.
Wow.
It should be falling apart after all these years. You know, that tape, it shouldn't exist, but they're still preserved.
Can you paint the picture of a typical night at the Cowtown Ballroom in its heyday?
Okay, I can paint your picture. First of all, we'll go with everything there is. Everybody's coming in, and the smell is unbelievable.
What is it?
Incense and dope. Everybody. I mean, you could, as a matter of fact, a policeman, if you had some marijuana, they would just take it from you. They wouldn't bother you. They'd give it to us. But they wouldn't arrest the kids.
So that's how it starts. It starts with the smell.
With the smell, you can smell, and the crowd gathering, you know, and everybody trying their best to be as peaceful. We never had one rowdy crowd, never, you know, we'd always have an opening act. The opening act would come on and perform, and then you'd have a break, and then the main act would come on. We had wonderful lights, and it was you can imagine, it wasn't that big, so it was always packed, and that feeling of being together, and it was okay, you know, and the music driving all night long. It was wonderful.
Did something happen there that has been sort of that changed the Kansas City music scene in any significant way, or was it just a time and a place that existed and now it's over?
it was a time and place that existed that could have, but unfortunately, the gentleman sold the building. And it stopped before it had its true potential. He sold the building and new owners wanted to use it for something else. And so that's always bad when you see an energy moving and it doesn't go to fruition. It's
Well, your voice, yeah, your voice is in some of the most recognizable commercial jingles in Kansas City, the Bob Jones shoes jingle and the grass
Downtown.
Pad. Yeah, will you sing those jingles, Bob the Bob Jones and the grass pad?
I'll sing the grass pad. Come on down to the grass pad. The grass pad's high on grass.
That song is legendary. Did they give you the lyrics or was that a bold experiment
on your
part?
That was a bold experiment. And they went along with it, and it was.
How many years ago was that?
Man, these things have left. See, my problem is that I write jingles that last forever, so I don't get another chance. I shoot myself in the foot. I have one, Angel Berry Realtors, that's been on so long, people call the station and beg them to take it off. They hate it, but it works. It has one of the most vomit lines I've ever written.
What is it?
It's a, anyone can find you a house. Takes an angel to find a home. Don't you just want to go?
Well, but that is, what's the secret to a good jingle then? You seem to have a knack for it.
Well, it's changed. Back then, it was almost a story. Now, it's a soundbite. It's you only write 8 seconds, and you put a bed in, then you pick up the 8 seconds. So it's a really different way of writing now, and so a good jingle now is just any good hook that you can say on radio.
Well, has Kansas City been a good place to make a living as a musician?
Well, making a living as a musician is a pretty new thing. We have to remember that it's only been in the last, since Stevenson, that anybody ever made living as a musician. There was no copyrights to music. You had to have a patron. And you had to sing and play what they wanted you to play or forget it.
Yeah.
You know? And this really has only been recent that, and before, musicians would work for drinks. So, most of the bars want to sell liquor, and they have to have music to do. So I should tell you right there, you know what I'm saying? There are a few clubs that do push music, and they don't last very long. And the rest of them, you're almost on your own. It's almost like you almost pay to be there.
Is that?
Expose yourself, you know?
Yeah, I mean, is that true everywhere, or is that a Kansas City problem?
Well, it's not really. Now, it's not really a problem in what I think of you when you think of music, and I think of music in Kansas City. I know we think of jazz and blues and things that are happening down at the crossroads. Okay, but the truth is, the music scene in Kansas City is none of those. If you're not playing rock and roll and country, you're looking for an audience.
Wow.
That's what there are clubs here that will get 2,000 people, family people, and don't even serve liquor because they play country.
They just don't have to?
They don't have to because they come for the music.
Central Standard's headed to one last break. You can check out photos of Danny Cox by Paul Andrews. They're on our website at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. You're listening to Central Standard, and today's show is a portrait session. Our subject is musician Danny Cox. Danny, I'm curious about your family. You have 10 kids?
Yes, I do.
Tell me about your wife. How long ago did the two of you meet?
Mona and I met 35 years ago.
Have marriage and fatherhood affected you as an artist?
It's made me write differently. It's affected my movement, but that's okay because I was tired of that to begin with.
Wait, but what do you mean? It's affected your movement.
Well, I spent the first 20 years, you know, as a single person, you know, because my first marriage didn't last long. Single person. So I was on the road 50 weeks out of the year, you know, about 20 years. So I was ready to stop.
Yeah, to settle down.
Yeah, to settle down. And we were given a home in Kansas City, Kansas. It was too small for us, but that's okay. When someone gives you a home, you move into
it. Yeah.
You know? And so the most kids we ever had in it at once, we had 8 children at one time in this house with one bathroom.
Am I remembering right that you experienced kind of a big fire a few years back?
Yes, my house burned down, and I lost 18 guitars.
Wow.
Some of them just treasures. My wife braids rugs. She lost all of her material, and we lost our 2 dogs.
Man.
But our children survived. We survived. We're the phoenix. You know what I mean? I had one son who was on scholarship playing trumpet down at Texas Southern. He left school and came up, and we had no insurance. And my other son was at Kent State, Kansas Community College. He left school, had 2 sons in high school. And these 4 and 5 had another son who was working. They built for us the home that we live in to this day, a 3-bedroom, 2-story home to code. Do you know how hard code is to this day?
I mean, I believe that it's hard. I've never experienced
it
firsthand.
It's unbelievable. It's code. We got people to pull the permits for us, and so my kids could do the work we played them. And they built this home that we live in.
That's incredible.
It is. It is.
Oh, I'm sorry to keep asking you emotional questions.
That's okay. No, it's okay. It's pretty incredible.
Do you want to listen to some more music? Let's start with an older one. Keep Your Hands Off It.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Belong to you. She's a greater, bigger mama. Got them a bigger whopping thighs, yeah. Great bigger mama, she got them a whopping thighs. Greater, bigger mama, bigger whopping thighs. She makes my temperature rise. Keep your hands off it, a Bodie Hotel. Keep your hands off it, oop oop a doo. Keep your hands off it, oh yeah. Keep your hands off it, you hear what I say. You know it don't belong to you. She's a greater, bigger mama. Got them a big, fine legs, yeah. A great, bigger mama, she got them big, fine legs. Greater, bigger mama, big, fine legs. Like a walking on a soft-boiled egg. Keep your hands off it. 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 I keep your hands off it. You hear what I say? You know it don't belong to you. Take a ride now.
What stands out to you about that song? Anything you want to say first?
Yes, this is a song that more people from the Vanguard remember. They come up to me and they say, "Keep your hands off it. Sing that song." And one of the reasons is that If you really listen to it, how time changes, it's kind of a sexist song.
How so?
It can be. you know?
Just because it
keep
describes...
it, because it knew it don't belong to you.
And
you know?
Using the word it.
Yeah, right. But it was done with such innocence and fun that none of that existed in it. And that's the beauty of this song. That's the beauty.
What about the song Ollie Brown?
Oh, that's a true story. There's a guy in my town of Cincinnati, Ollie Brown.
Yeah, that song is a story. What's the story?
The story is just pretty much about, you know, how desperate people are in their lives. And Ollie Brown was desperate. He was, but he had something special about him.
Ollie Brown is only 12 years old, but you can see him on the street. Hustling everybody just to try to help to make ends meet. His daddy lost his welfare pay, a gambled it away. Only one big chance for the ticket to ride. Mr. Brown would like to get back on his feet, but the only job that he can get pays 55. Take home pay a week, yeah. And it just don't make no sense to work when you can get 64 tax-free from the government. Now Mr. Brown reads where they're trying to take away his 64. He reads the paying farmers 200,000 not to grow. And he ain't growed a lick since 1926. And maybe you really do owe him just a little bit more. You wonder why he wants to burn it down. And you wonder why he finds hope in his little bag of gold out of ground. Don't let him burn it down. Help him find his way. Show him the brand new day.
Is you know, the father would gamble away the money, you know, just for the chance that maybe. You know, I just got paid. I worked all week. And if I don't do anything, I'm not going to have anything. So they go out and they gamble it and they lose it, you know. And you sort of saw it in my neighborhood. You'd have a woman, the fruit of their labors. At the time, they thought that the condom was a form of genocide, really. They're saying they're trying to create genocide in the black community.
The condom?
Yes.
Explain that.
The condome. They wanted to regulate the amount of children that blacks had, you know? Not safety, regulate the number of children. And a woman, you know, this was her fruit, you know, with these children, you know? And so, and that's basically what it's about the fact that they're paying... guys, at that time, listen to the numbers, $64 a week. That's what you were getting on welfare. What is $64 a week? But they're paying farmers $200,000 not to grow. Is that not welfare? Don't grow and we'll pay you $200,000. And these same guys are saying, well, why are you giving them people money on welfare? You know? And the point is that the Ollie Browns are everywhere. That's why I say they're in the coal mines in Kentucky and West Virginia. They're picking grapes in California. They're everywhere. The Ollie Browns.
There's a recent song from a musical you wrote about the Negro Leagues called Working Man's Game. Can you tell us about that song and about the message you're trying to get across?
Yeah. Baseball is a product of people, what they did after they worked all day. The swing, the movement, the swing of the baseball. Can you see a guy with a scythe out in the field moving? Bucking hay, that same motion. You grab the hay and you throw it up. It was a working man's game. You turned a screw and you developed huge forearms. Nobody does that today. Nobody knows what that's about. So that's why most of the guys in baseball were farm kids. So when the game became a city game and they didn't do this anymore, they had to go to the gym to develop those muscles that they would have naturally have developed working on a farm.
So the working man's game, we think of, I think, professional athletes, mm-hmm. as being these sort of glorious figures. You know what I mean? We don't think of that as a working man's activity anymore. But was your father was in Negro Leagues?
He was a Negro. He played for a team called the Atlanta Black Crackers. Isn't that a great name?
Yeah.
The Atlanta Black Crackers. So in my home, these men were gods. And so it says, you know, baseball is a working man's game. Town or country, it's all the same. Build up the muscle, slap it on your frame. Baseball is a working man's game, you know?
Danny Cox, Kansas City musician, thanks so much for sitting down and chatting today. It's been really cool getting to know you.
Well, thank you very much. And hi to all my friends out there and people I hope that we'll be friends.
Our interview with Danny Cox is part of our Portrait Session series in partnership with photographer Paul Andrews. Portrait Sessions are in-depth interviews with the most interesting people in Kansas City. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with Fridays by Jen Chen. And we pull it off thanks to lots of help from Patrick Quick and intern Daniel Booth. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. Paul Andrews is our Portrait Sessions partner. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs right here in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend and stick around for Up to Date. Next.
Dream a plan in the majors. They